Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Inside Indie Sports Podcast. I'm Tyler James, and I'm joined once again by the one and only Eric Hansen. Together, we cover Notre Dame football, recruiting, and more for InsideIndieSports.com on the Rivals Network. Notre Dame's blue-gold game is almost a week away, which means we're running out of live football observations to make until August. That will lead us to many more conversations to college football and college sports at large. And these days, it's hard to really have those without the knowledge of a lawyer. That's why we've invited Sportico legal expert Michael McCann, who's also a professor of law at New Hampshire and visiting professor of law at Harvard, back onto the Inside Indy Sports Podcast. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Great to be back, Tyler. Good to see you and Eric.
Michael, I guess a broad question to start. What do you think is the current legal battle that has the potential to have the biggest impact on college athletics?
I think Dartmouth College, the players being recognized as employees and now forming a union, clearly the school's opposing it, but that's the game changer, because if that ultimately succeeds, it would really change college sports in a profound way, where the athletes would be recognized as employees, as they've argued they should be. That's sort of the players' argument. And the precedent that would be set would affect other private colleges, of which, of course, there are a lot of them. There are a lot of big name private colleges in college sports. The other major change that I think is something to watch for, which interestingly is something that Charlie Baker, the NCAA president, has proposed, which is direct NIL payments by colleges. Now, many would say that's already happening through boosters and collectives. I realize that. But if there's sort of this transparent system where colleges pay athletes what they'll call NIL, I don't know if it will be NIL, it might really be recruiting payments, but that would be huge, because that would certainly advantage some schools more than others. And it would also reflect another profound change in college sports, which is that players are paid. And that would end the model that is the traditional model. Many would say it's not a good model, that it's unfair or illegal, but that would be a big change. And I think at that point, if there's direct pay to players, we're really talking about a different creature in terms of college sports. And again, there'd be winners and losers from that.
There's a lot there that I want to follow up on, but I'm going to follow up on the NIL branch, because I think that's coming quicker. And I'm more confused by it. Well, people ask me all the time, they're like, well, do these guys get lump sums? Do they get a monthly salary? What's going on with this? But do you think for the athlete and for the school, what Charlie Baker is proposing is a better world? Is it even the playing field a little bit more? Does it make it less sleazy, or is it still going to be this kind of dark world that we really don't understand and everybody kind of exaggerates about what's going on?
Yeah, I think the dark world's always there. I don't think that goes away in any arrangement, but I do think what Baker proposes is a much more transparent system, and it would create predictability. It would create some sense of, here are the rules, colleges can pay athletes NIL. And maybe they're not really. And I mean, to me, this is interesting, because NIL is supposed to be really an endorsement deal, right? Yeah. Use of somebody's name, image, and likeness, or their signature, or their, if they're a singer, their voice, whatever it may be. And that's not NIL. What we're talking about, we can call it NIL. We can call, you know, anything NIL. It's really payment for recruiting. And look, I mean, the athletes, some of these athletes are worth a lot, right? They're coveted by top colleges. We all remember when Jameis Winston was recruited out of high school. What would he have been paid if his market value was recognized? I mean, he was an elite recruit that had major programs recruiting him. And there clearly are high school athletes that are worth more than a full ride to whatever, even very expensive colleges. Mm-hmm. So
he would have had carte blanche at Publix.
Right. Public. Yeah. Different story. Although, you know, Alabama football, what will they pay? And it's going to be interesting, Eric, because to the extent that this leads to recognition of athletes as employees and maybe unionizing, labor laws in the South are a lot different than labor laws in the North and Midwest. And there could be some shifts there that advantage schools in the North and Midwest more so than in the South. So we'll have to see how that plays out.
Michael, I've been kind of critical of the NCAA sort of waiting, seemingly, for politicians to fix their problems as it relates to NIL and player employment. But did the NCAA sort of need and still need the lawmakers to sort of set a path because of how many legal challenges seem to be coming up with anything that NCAA is trying to do anymore?
Well, I would say this. I think the NCAA could try a lot more. And it's interesting because antitrust cases usually are really hard to win. Most antitrust defendants win. It's only the NCAA that keeps losing. I mean, that just shows sort of what how kind of inept they've been with legal matters. And I think the NCAA could do a lot more in terms of creating reasonable restrictions for college sports that would pass legal scrutiny. What they've done over the years, as we all know, is they create these sort of bright line rules that are unforgiving and seem really unfair. I mean, the days of, a kid gets a sandwich and he loses his eligibility. I mean, that doesn't sound fair because it isn't fair. And I think when there are rules set up like that, it delegitimizes the whole system. And I think Charlie Baker, and look, I live in Massachusetts. He was my governor, a really good governor. Not ideological, kind of like pragmatic. And I think if he took that philosophy to the NCAA, he could do a lot more than they're doing. I don't know if his hands are tied. I mean, it's like a mini government, right? The NCAA with conferences, and I feel like there's like 1,000 working committees, and it's this huge bureaucracy that probably slows it down. I don't know if Congress needs to do anything. I think the NCAA could do a lot more. I also don't know what Congress could do. I mean, I think they couldn't even get a federal NIL bill through. What the NCAA wants is something a lot more complicated, a lot more divisive. And here's the other thing. The irony of it all is that if college athletes were employees and unionized, it would be so easy for colleges. They would just negotiate CBAs, just like in pro sports. Think of the disputes we don't hear. Do we hear anything about, I know there have been lockouts over the years, but generally they're pretty peaceful, or the NBA and the NBA Players Association. We don't hear these sort of labor fights. I mean, it's like a predictable set of rules. So the NCAA and its members, I think, have chosen a path so far that's litigious, and they're losing. Litigious is fine if you win. It's not so good if you keep losing cases.
So for me, as I look at the NCAA now, somebody that's been around it when it was all powerful, and now it feels like, you're a 20-year-old and you have your own apartment, your parents are trying to impose curfew on you. It just doesn't feel like there's power there. And I'm wondering, do you think, at least from a football standpoint, the NCAA is in its last days, or do you feel like the NCAA needs to exist with Charlie Baker's leadership? Maybe they get a second win and a little bit more power and structure.
I think the NCAA could be useful for a lot of sports, particularly not football and maybe not basketball. I think for the other sports, having some sort of national entity that has reasonable rules for competition probably has a lot of benefits, a lot of efficiencies. I think, Eric, your point of on college football, I think the conferences are running college football. And I think we're going to increase, especially as look at the conferences, but Pac-12 gone. ACC is suing its members, and its members are suing the ACC. That doesn't look too good. So now we've got three left, and maybe it eventually morphs into two, sort of two super conferences that kind of look like a pro league, right? Eastern Conference, Western Conference, something like that. I mean, I think conferences, they don't need the NCAA, clearly, right? They don't need the NCAA for TV rights. They don't need the NCAA for licensing. They don't need the NCAA for just basic rules of operations. And if I'm Charlie Baker, I'm thinking, rather than fight to hold on to something that I'm going to lose anyway, let's focus on the stuff that we can really get done. The basketball tournament is great, right? Look at, I mean, both men's and women's tournament. Look at the ratings. It's a great tournament. They should play to their strengths and come up with more reasonable rules. I think football is sort of evolving into a pro. Maybe it's already there. It's sort of like a pro league at this point. And I don't think the NCAA, like you said, Eric, this sort of curfew with the college kid in an apartment doesn't work.
Michael, is there room for there to be some sort of football czar within the NCAA? Like it has its own rules. Is that possible for the NCAA to still oversee football in a different format than the rest of its athletics?
Maybe, although I think the conferences would say we're already doing that. We don't need someone else in the room, right? There's, you have the sort of the remaining Power Five, Power Four. I think they would say we don't need that. We don't need another level of bureaucracy. And also, if I'm those conferences, I'm thinking, why do we want the NCAA? Like, what are they keep losing in court? They're like a perpetual defendant, right? And I don't know if it's good to sort of hitch the wagon to the NCAA when they're really losing. And I think conferences on their own can, and we know they do, they negotiate their own TV deals. And so, yeah, I mean, I could see maybe not the NCAA, Tyler, I could see those conferences get together, pick some sort of point person, like a commissioner,
right?
Like I don't know if they call, I guess commissioner wouldn't be the word because they already have commissioners, but something above a commissioner, like a, you know, some kind of
grand poobah,
right? high priest of football,
high priest, right? something I don't know is above commissioner, but CEO. There you go.
So about a week or so ago, I had a chance to sit down with Notre Dame's new athletic director, Pete Bavakwa, and we talked about the evolving student athlete model. And he seemed really optimistic that there are enough people around college sports that care about it, that this student athlete model isn't going to become unrecognizable. And I guess what I want to ask you, though, is what I hear from fans are, I think they're worried that these changes will change the culture of college sports, that it won't be, I'm playing for my brothers next to me or whatever. It's going to be, I'm playing for my next paycheck or whatever the CBA says. Do you think that from a cultural standpoint, all these changes will eventually change the game so much of us love in terms of it looking more like pro models and pro cultures?
I think whatever happens, however it shakes out, I think there will still be a college sports brand that, whether athletes are paid, whether they have a CBA that limits what the coach can do in terms of discipline, whether they have more control over their hours, whether they're allowed to be part-time students rather than having to have 15 credits and 45 hours a week on sports. I still think there will be a college brand, and maybe it's a different brand. It's a different model than the traditional student athlete model, but I'll tell you, a model that's not in court every day, that's not before federal agencies, I don't think the current model is good. It's literally like a target for antitrust lawyers. And the reason why is because it doesn't, we saw in NCAA versus Alston, Justice Kavanaugh, in his concurring opinion, he said, this whole thing is just a giant cartel, right? And if we call it that, then what are we holding on to, right? Because that, and I realize people like tradition, like I get it. You know, I went to Georgetown, right? Like, I mean, I get tradition and all of that. But I'll tell you, tradition doesn't hold up in court. And when tradition loses 9-0 at the Supreme Court, with conservative and liberal justices who don't get along on all sorts of things, as we know, right? Like if you go 0-9 there, it's not probably something to hold on to. So I think it will evolve into something else. I still think there'll be a lot of interest in it. I think the brands that college, I mean, Notre Dame, I mean, that brand, whether athletes get money or not, that brand is not going to be affected. I do think at smaller private colleges, particularly because we're entering sort of the cliff in terms of enrollment, where we're going to see colleges competing for fewer college-age students while paying athletes, there are going to be some challenges for university presence. I think Notre Dame's going to be fine. I mean, you know, but I think once you start getting lower on the totem pole in terms of revenue, that model may end up really leading to some choices in terms of maybe converting teams to club. So I think it depends on what school we're talking about.
So, Michael, with the unionization battle with the Dartmouth men's basketball team, what is sort of the timeline to expect resolution with that? Because it seems like it's you get a step closer, but that means there's just that much more playing field left. And then how will what happens there impact different schools? Obviously, there's the private versus public aspect of it, but does the fact that this is an Ivy League school that doesn't offer scholarships, does that play a role in how that would set precedents for even other private colleges?
Yeah, so in terms of timeline, it could take a while to play out. If it goes the max, we're talking years probably. And I say that because the appeal to the National Labor Relations Board, first the NLRB has to actually accept to hear it, and then if they accept to hear it, then there'll be months before a decision. If you remember with Northwestern, where their football players tried to form a union, that was 16 months. From the decision to the NLRB doing a review. So that pushes us into summer of 2025. And then whatever that decision is, the loser can challenge it in federal court. And then ultimately the Supreme Court could conceivably take it. So that's probably 2, 3, maybe even 4 years, depending upon how long the reviews take. So that's not likely to be resolved soon, unless the NLRB board says, this is a layup. They prove their case. They prove their case because the school controls their time, and their compensation wasn't a wage, but it was getting preferential admissions. And the Ivy League, they don't give athletic scholarships, but they kind of give something better. If you go there, it's need-based aid. So even if you quit the team, you're still a student at Dartmouth. You still get 4 years of conceivably a full ride, rather than having to play for a team. So I don't know how long it's going to take, but it's not certainly going to be immediate, but it could go faster depending upon what the NLRB does. The impact on other colleges, you're right, it's different because there's no athletic scholarships. In a way, if athletes can prove their employees without a scholarship, I mean, that would suggest it's even easier to prove employment status
Right.
at a school where they're actually getting paid to play a sport. So, and the unique thing about Ivy League, the problem for Northwestern, the football players, is they play in a conference where everyone else is a public school, and the NLRB board didn't want to have employees at one and not others. Ivy League, they're all private, right? Eight private schools. So it's kind of like a really smart route, even though it wasn't. And I'll be honest with you, somebody said, we're going to see the path to employee rec athletes as employees in college through the Ivy League. I would have said, what? Right?
Yeah.
But it actually makes sense because they're all private schools. So the issue of some public, some private, to answer, I mean, others. So the answer is it doesn't make anyone else an employee automatically. The athletes would have to petition the NLRB to say they want to bargain, they want to form a union. And then there could be hearing, but it becomes precedent.
So, Michael, one of the other things that I get, fans that are distressed over the changes are the player movement. I mean, we're really now at unrestricted player movement, or we're soon going to be there where you can transfer every year and so forth. Would athletes as employees slow that down at all? Would you maybe sign players to multi-year contracts? I mean, would there, or are we just going to see this every year, all these players move and some of them to the highest bidder?
If they're employees, if they have a contract, they can't breach it. So it would actually restrict movement if they're in an employment relationship. And unless they're at will, if they're at will, I guess they could just quit, like they could be fired too. But I presume in that world, there's some sort of, like, if it's not a contract, some appointment letter. If they're in a union, there would be a collective bargaining agreement. So it's interesting you raise that, Eric, because to the extent that players jumping around a lot is a concern, them being employees would actually limit their movement because they would have an employment obligation. It's kind of one benefit for schools that maybe are reticent about athletes becoming employees, that they would actually gain more control over them.
Michael, one of the latest things Charlie Baker has come out wanting to lead a charge with is a ban of prop bets on college sports. Do you think that he can make that happen?
I think he can make progress in getting states to ban. It's a state by state thing, right? So he'd have to. I don't think Congress is going to do anything. I think he could make a pretty good case that, I mean, honestly, prop bets I think are really concerning, right? For all sorts of reasons that, I mean, it just invites opportunities to have players be able to make money on themselves without people noticing. And whether they're college or pro, I think he can make a pretty good argument that it's a concern. The issue is going to be sort of the going state by state, the fact that the NCAA doesn't have the greatest sort of reputation right now, probably. I think the fact that he's doing it helps, that he's new and, you know, people don't dislike him too much yet. You know, he's not Mark Emmert, right? Like, I think you get a honeymoon period before you start getting hated. It's like any job, right? Any leader.
Right.
Eventually they hate you, no matter who you are. So
Did they ever love Mark
I don't know. Maybe
Emmert?
not. Maybe not. Although I gotta admit, I was on a Senate hearing with him. He was pretty impressive. I know he's sort of like a magnet for criticism. I gotta give him credit. He was actually really knowledgeable, and it struck me. But yeah, he was not on the charm offensive, I guess you could say. And people didn't seem to like him very much. Baker, I think, will have more interpersonal skills. So yeah, I mean, I think he can make a good case. But I don't know, you know, how quickly that's going to play out.
All right, Michael, that's all we have for you. How can folks keep up with your work at Sportico?
Well, if you go to Sportico, you'll see me there and a lot of other great writers. I mean, I'm really always impressed by my colleagues and stuff that they write on sports business. It's really, I always learn something. So I hope people go on Sportico and check it out. Really good stuff there. And, hey, you know, there's no shortage of things to write about.
Well, for our listeners, seriously, they break it down so well that you can understand it. You will not get a headache if you read the Sportico version of these stories.
Right. And they're not boring, right? They're pretty interesting. And a lot of, you know, the nice thing about Sportico is these charts that we have a great data viz person who, I mean, I don't know, it's like a talent being able to do visuals.
One
All
that I
right.
don't
And
we
I don't have
don't
either. I don't have either. Trust me. I don't go near that stuff.
All right, Michael, we appreciate your time. Have a good day.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Before we get to our question segment, I wanted to remind our listeners of our subscription promo for InsideIndieSports.com. We're offering a 30-day free trial to our podcast listeners who want to try out a subscription to the site. That will get you access to all of our premium content, the Insider Lounge message board, and you don't have to wait for the next podcast to ask us a question. You can take advantage of this offer by using promo code NDPOD, that's NDPOD, when you sign up for a subscription on InsideIndieSports.com. You can also find a link to the deal in the podcast description or show notes. All right, now it's time for questions. You can submit questions to us on Twitter or the Insider Lounge message board before every podcast. I'm at TJamesND and Eric's at EHansonND. First one I have for us, Eric, is from Bob Oxnard on the Insider Lounge. Aside from using Jalen Snead as a pass rusher in obvious passing situations, can Al Golden get Osbury or Snead on the field even when opponents have quick slash shifty pass catchers in the slot?
The whole concept of having a rover when Mike Elko brought it to Notre Dame and Clark Lee followed up on it was for those kind of situations so that you didn't get caught with the wrong personnel on the field. And really, the guy that has expressed that the best is Jeremiah Owusu-Koramoah. Notre Dame didn't ever have to go to nickel if they didn't want to because he was so good at that. Athletically, both of those guys would have the traits to be that person. I don't think either one is quite there yet. I think what you might see with Snead that gets you closer to that concept is on third down, you may see the middle linebacker exit Drake Bowen and have Kaiser and Snead be on the field together with the nickel package. If there are three linebackers, I think Jaden Osbury is closer to a regular rover. I had a chance to talk to him the other day, and they're not only working him at rover, he's taking nickel reps right now. He's taking reps at safety. He's taking reps at the Aztec role, which was what DJ Brown would play in Notre Dame's spear package. which is an extra defensive back package where the safeties kind of play in the box and so forth. So he is moving in that direction. I know that they like their nickel Jordan Clark a lot, but it does give them more versatility if these guys can be third down linebackers, or if they get caught in the wrong personnel on the field, that they can function. So I do think they're moving in that direction.
Yeah, I think the most likely path for them to get on the field is if Drake Bowen comes off the field or Jack Kaiser comes off the field at times, and those guys, they just choose to have more athletic linebackers out there and use them in different combinations. The Aztec role, I think, is something that is intriguing, particularly for Jaden Osbury. I don't have a ton of confidence that Jaden Osbury can be a true nickel, like replace Jordan Clark one for one. So I'd be curious to see what that looked like. Essentially, he'd just be playing a Rover linebacker role, but given maybe more coverage situations there. So Jaden Osbury is someone that Notre Dame is very high on and has received a lot of praise this spring. And I'm looking forward to see maybe some actual real stuff to discuss on practice from him on Saturday. All right, next question is from Marie Biafore at Biafore underscore Marie. For each of you, what are the biggest positive and biggest negative surprises of the spring so far?
Yeah, and some of these came earlier in the spring. I would say four players that, and again, sometimes what's a surprise to somebody else isn't a surprise to me and vice versa, because I have high expectations for a guy like Jaden Osbury, for example. But I would say Micah Gilbert, Adon Schuler, Bryce Young, and Cooper Flanagan in varying degrees have surprised me. I thought all of them would have good springs. I think they've exceeded that. For, you know, not so good surprises, I feel bad for Tyson Ford that we haven't heard more about him making an impact and moving up the depth chart in the defensive line. I'd say a big disappointment has been who put the plate in Riley Leonard's ankle for the first surgery, since that caused a stress fracture. I'd say Clarence Lewis for leaving at Easter break. Really, I don't think there have been a lot of disappointments, and we haven't seen enough of the offensive line yet. We will Saturday to see where their progress is going, but it seemed like Mike Denbrock was happy with their progress, which I would take that to the bank.
Yeah, we've seen so little meaningful practice that it feels hard to have like a lot of negative takeaways, because it's like, well, even if you see something in a small period, like, you don't necessarily think, or I think it's a little bit foolish to jump to like, okay, this is what's happening all the time for that player. So I had a hard time coming up with negative surprises. I think the Riley Leonard, the fact that he didn't make it through healthy was a negative surprise. The Clarence Lewis transfer was a negative surprise given the timing of it. And I guess you just say the fact that Benjamin Morrison got hurt is a negative surprise too, but the positive surprise, I thought, above all, was Micah Gilbert. I think he's been the biggest positive surprise. People can't seem to stop talking about him. It doesn't matter who you ask about, like, who's playing well, even if it's someone that's not playing his position or even guarding him, as in terms of a defensive back, Micah Gilbert's name tends to come up as someone who's had a really good spring. All right, the next question is from the Irish Network at Irish Net. Who do you believe are the top five receivers, wide receivers, or tight ends on the team?
I think once everybody is healthy, this would be my order, and I'm not in love with this order, but I'm going to go Mitchell Evans, Jaden Thomas, Jaden Greathouse, Chris Mitchell, and Eli Raridan, and I'm certainly open to changing that, but that's what I'm kind of got in my mind right now.
See those again?
Evans, Jake Thomas, Jaden Greathouse, Chris Mitchell, Eli Raridan.
Okay, cool. We have four of the five the same. I have Jordan Faison in there instead of Eli Raridan. So I had Chris Mitchell, Jaden Greathouse, Mitchell Evans, Jaden Thomas, and Jordan Faison as my top five. All right. Okay. Next question is from Kevin Mitchie at KMitchie32. Will we have four quarterbacks going into the fall? Also, who are the top five players you are excited to see play in the fall that's not the quarterback?
So I know what Kevin's asking. He's asking if somebody's going to transfer out of those four. I mean, they'll have Anthony Rizak will be a pretty good walk-on and be a fourth quarterback, and I think probably a scout team guy if somebody transfers. And I guess they'll have him, even if somebody doesn't transfer, he'll still be here. I'm going to lean that they will have four, but I'm not super confident about it. I don't know what Angeli's going to do. And the people that I'm excited non-quarterbacks to see in the fall, I kind of went with, I really, and so the word was excited. And the thing that excites me about watching a player is the guy that's just turning the corner on their career or coming to a significant point in their career and they accomplish it. So in that light, otherwise, I mean, I just take the five best players. So I put Billy Shrouth in this because I think he's going to be maybe Notre Dame's best lineman this year. And I think he's going to make a lot of progress, and it kind of significant. I'm excited about watching the whole offensive line play. Now they may not play well, but I'm excited to see it. Chris Mitchell, because of his speed, to see if that translates from the you know, kind of mid-major to big time football. And if he can take the top off the defense, it's going to change Notre Dame's offense. Boubacar Traore, not just because I like to say Boubacar, but I think he's an exciting pass rusher. Jalen Snead, if not now, then when with him? And then Jadarian Price, just because he was so exciting his freshman spring, then got hurt. He showed enough last year when he was coming back from an Achilles injury. I was excited about him. I really want to see what he can do at 100%. And that's not a knock to Jeremiah Love or anybody else. I just think I think there's a lot more to Price than what we saw last year.
Yeah, Price is also on my list. He was the only one that we both had on our list. I had a combination of guys that are maybe trending towards breakout roles and then a couple that are already stars that I just like to watch their greatness. So I went with Jadarian Price. I couldn't just pick one running back, so I went with Jeremiah Love as well, because I think both of those guys have a chance to be really exciting this season. I included Drake Bowen as a linebacker in terms of what he's going to be able to do in the middle of Notre Dame's defense. I think if he can be as good as he was advertised to be, I think that's a very positive development for Notre Dame's defense. And then the other two guys are the proven guys, Benjamin Morrison and Xavier Watts. I think I just really enjoy watching those guys play football. And so I felt like I couldn't exclude them from my list. As for the four quarterbacks, I would lean towards no, just because I don't know. That seems like the reality of college football anymore. So I'll continue to just predict no until proven wrong. And if I'm wrong and they're all four here, then I'll be fine with that as well. Next question is from at Charles W. Wolf. If Riley Leonard can't go, will it be Angeli versus Kenny Minchie / CJ Carr in the blue gold game?
I don't even think they should mess with Riley Leonard. I don't think his sense. I asked him if he was going to play in the blue gold game, and mm-hmm. he didn't think he was. And he's a guy that would love to play in a pickup basketball game if somebody asked him. So
Didn't he say if it was the season he would be playing?
Yeah, right. So, but assuming that he's not going, I would think they're going to make it Angeli versus Minchie and mix in a little bit of CJ Carr, maybe on both sides, and then maybe have that running clock in the second half with a lot of the reserves. They may have CJ take all those reps, but I'm not sure. We'll find out. I'm sure that'll get asked Saturday when we talk to Marcus after the media only practice.
Yeah, someone's gonna have to play for both teams, I think. I don't, because there's not a fourth quarterback available. There's not like a walk-on quarterback that Notre Dame uses in practices even, so you can't really do two versus two. So I guess, yeah, maybe the first half is Angeli versus Minchie versus Carr, or Minchie and Carr, those two split, and then Minchie and Carr sort of split apart in the second half, and they're playing on opposite teams. I think that would be my guess, but we're just venturing a guess at this point. I don't know when the player draft is. I don't know if we've received any information about that, if they're still going to make a big deal out of it as they have at times in the past. Next question is from at James McGray. Minchie or Angeli?
I'm not sure the context there, but I will say Angeli for now. I think long term, Minchie's the wild card in this quarterback thing. He may have the best material of any of them, but given the experience, the growth curve of Angeli, I would take Angeli in a game right now. I think in some ways CJ Carr is even more of a known than Minchie, but man, I would never write Kenny Minchie off in terms of potential.
Yeah. Gino Gadulli was talking about it being a gunslinger, and he just like, there's no opportunity to make a pass that Kenny Minchie wants to pass up. He likes slinging the rock. So, I think Kenny Minchie could be a very exciting player. I think it could be maybe a more volatile player. But yeah, like the way I thought of it was just like right now I'm taking Steve Angeli. I guess like in a world where they both stay at Notre Dame, going into next season, I would still probably take Angeli over Minchie currently. All right. Next question is from Fire Your Job at the_JackAttack. Which position needs the most work from a recruiting standpoint in 2025?
I'm going to defer this one to you, Tyler.
In terms of getting commitments, I think it's cornerback. Notre Dame only has one in Cree Thomas, but they are also in a good position with three recruits who could commit. So I think they're on the verge of being in a very good position there. They just have to sort of close there. I think the wide receiver position would be the other one that I would mention, that they do have three commitments there, but they're not superstars. And I'd like to see Notre Dame get two more receivers in the class, which I think Notre Dame is trending toward if it can get the right two guys in a combination. I think there's probably two or three guys, maybe even four, that they would take two more guys for. So I think that.
Who do you think those will be? Who do you think the two they should try to lock down? Who would you pick?
Well, if it's no bearing on the probability of it, I would say give me Derek Meadows and Javon Boggs. I think those are the two that I would prioritize. Yeah. In terms of the two that I think would be the most likely to end up at Notre Dame, it would be Derek Meadows and Tanook Hines, who was just on campus last weekend. So, and then the other person in that mix would be Taylen Taylor, who's from the Chicago area. I don't think that Notre Dame is in a lead position for both Georgia and Ohio State are battling really hard there for him as well. So I think Notre Dame has some work to do if they want to get him in the class. The other one I would mention would be Viper defensive end, Damian Shanklin, if things don't work out there, which it's trending towards that direction. Then I think Notre Dame doesn't really even have any viable targets remaining that I'm aware of. Maybe there's some things going on behind the scenes and they can change course quickly. But some of the guys that are even listed as defensive ends that Notre Dame's been recruiting are more defensive tackles than they are Vipers. So Notre Dame does have Dominic Kulak in the class who is projected to play Viper, but I think the hope was that they would get another Viper there. And I don't see a great option for Notre Dame based on what's happened in the past. But obviously there's still time to make changes to that and sort of redirect and get someone else if Notre Dame wants to. All right. Next question is from at Notre Dame expert walking home from work. Who is the best Notre Dame player from IMG Academy? And I will mention that this came with a photo from Times Square of an IMG Academy ad. So that's why it was mentioned that Notre Dame expert was walking home from work.
Okay. Well, good exercise. They've only had a handful of IMG guys. I'd say Houston Griffith was the highest rated, but wasn't the best player. I would give that to Robert Hainsey.
Yeah, I think the breakdown of the four IMG Academy players that Notre Dame has had is pretty clear to me. It's Haynes at the top. Second is Tony Jones Jr. Then it's Houston Griffith, and then Spencer Perry. I think it's a pretty easy power ranking to do based off of the careers that they had, both in college and in the pros. Haynes and Jones have stuck around in the NFL for a few seasons now. All right, our last question is from Fort Worth Hoosier at Christian Honap. Will the A&M game be a night game?
I think most writers hope it's not. I think it probably will be. I don't know why it wouldn't be, but I'm not sure. So I will say yes.
Yeah, the only reason it wouldn't be is that Georgia-Clemson is also that weekend, and both of those games belong to ESPN. So I can't imagine they would put those two games up against each other. My hunch would be that the Georgia-Clemson game, because it's in Atlanta, it's in a dome, it would be easier to play in the afternoon. I think sometimes, I know the Texas schools don't like playing earlier games. Afternoon's not as bad as like a noon game, but I don't know how much the TV networks care about that sometimes either. I don't have a strong prediction. I would guess that it would be a night game, but I think there's a chance that it could just be an afternoon game. All right, that is it for today's episode of the Inside Indy Sports Podcast. If you don't already, you can subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and other popular podcast platforms. If you like what you hear, give us a star rating, leave a review, and share our podcast feed with a legal professional. As I mentioned earlier, we're offering a 30-day free trial to our podcast listeners who want to try out a subscription to InsideIndySports.com. So please take advantage of that with code NDPOD. That's NDPOD. Football Never Sleeps will be back on YouTube on Monday, where we should have plenty to discuss after seeing Saturday's scrimmage, and we'll be back on the podcast later next week to look ahead to the Blue-Gold game. Until then, stick with InsideIndySports.com for all your Notre Dame coverage needs.